Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Go for it.
I just briefly touched that fish sauce and it's pungent, man. I can smell it on my fingers already. What have we got before us, Tom?
So, as you are an ancient Roman, yeah, the welcome thing you usually have is some nuts, some dried fruits, and you start your meal with something like that. So we have dates, hazelnuts, walnuts, and dried figs. And we have a salad. It's cucumber salad, but marinated with sweet wine, red wine vinegar, mint, and fish sauce.
Yum, yum.
And a bit of olive oil. So that's kind of, one of the dishes from Apicius again.
The funny thing about this is it looks a little bit like smashed cucumber with soy sauce.
You know? I think all of the dishes will bring you to that, a bit of Asia. Actually, the cucumber is homegrown and it's been pickled. So I've pickled it and now I'm marinating on this dressing.
Wow, you're a generous host, Tom. Well, yeah, I'm getting the fish sauce there. That's intense.
But it mixes well with all the rest, the ingredients here. Mm. So, and then here we have yellow split peas.
Mm-hmm. It looks like hummus.
And it looks like hummus. So yeah, they're boiled with onion and carrot and olive oil and vinegar. And you have like a type of porridge, let's say, fava. Mm-hmm. It's called fava in Greek. And what's happening? So in modern Greece, you find a lot. It's called fava. Mm-hmm. So yellow split pea puree. And it was popular in the ancient world as well. You would have chickpeas, you would have lentils, and yellow split peas mm-hmm. were the main pulses in the ancient Europe. Mm-hmm. All the bean stuff, it's from Americas. So you wouldn't have any beans. Mm-hmm. But you have peas, yellow split peas, lentils, and chickpeas.
Am I right in thinking that it was only really the elites that are eating the kind of food that we're making now, like the burgers and the meat and stuff, but the majority of the population were living off things like pulses.
Yeah,
porridges.
Most of the time, yes, and bread and porridges. But there was definitely a bigger population that it was considered middle class, let's say. There was lots of merchants and there was lots of retired soldiers that they made some money. And you have, because you had an empire which was very expansive, you have a lot of
diversity and difference
yeah.
and unevenness. Yeah,
yeah.
And when we're talking about when we're talking about the Romans in Britain, all of these things are would have been completely foreign prior to the occupation, to Britain. So
occupation, yes.
Yeah. Well, we can use that word, or yeah. Which word would you rather use?
I would. Yeah, I think that's a good word.
I mean, it's not like the Celts really wanted the Romans there, did they?
No, no.
I mean, there was. I got the impression that there was a small number of people in the south of England who, even prior to the Romans coming and invading Britain, were kind of welcoming of them. And there was like trade happening already and there was some wine drinking going on. There was a little bit of commodity exchange.
Yeah, of course, of course.
So there was a small number of tribes, people, chiefs and so on, who would have welcomed the Romans and were quite ready to integrate. But by and large, the Romans had to fight tooth and nail. It took them like 4 years to get to London.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
London wasn't, yeah, did London yeah, exist, yeah. But to get to the Thames.
Thames, yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah. Hello, welcome back to The Delicious Legacy, an archaeogastronomical adventure through space and time,
I'm your host, Thomas Dinas. And on this episode, I have a very special guest with me. So I invited Louis Bassett, the creator, producer, and presenter of the Full English podcast, one of my favorite food podcasts out there, for a little discussion. What have the Romans ever done for us? The internal question. Apart from the roads, aqueducts, trade, and so on, they also left their mark into the edible history of this country as well. Together with Louis, we got into some very interesting diversions in our long discussion, trying to find the beginnings of Roman food in Britain and what's left from it. And it's very interesting to see that we're discussing spices and the blandness in food and the Christian morals and ethics and how all this stuff might be a legacy of Rome. I invited Louis over my house, and together we cooked an ancient Roman meal inspired partly by Apicius and partly by findings in archaeological sites throughout Britain. It was a super interesting conversation that lasted about 3 hours, together with the cooking, of course, and the eating. And we explored the many aspects of Rome's influence in the society in ancient Britain, but also how that legacy is translated and transferred to more modern times. What did the Victorians, for example, thought about Rome and the influence of Rome in Britain and the empire as such? And simultaneously, we tried to delve into the life of everyday Britons back 2,000 years ago. And if those events that the Romans thought as life-changing and important were in any way influential to everyday people's lives back then. And so, without further delay, let's get into our episode. Enjoy!
Let's set the scene. So let's... Louis, welcome to my kitchen. Welcome to the Delicious Legacy Kitchen.
Thank you so much for having me around.
And let's talk about Roman British food, whatever the Romans done for us.
Quite a lot, we're going to find out. Yeah, I mean, we already know that. Everyone always thinks of roads, right? But we're doing food.
Yeah, roads are not important.
No.
I mean...
it's just like, you know, why do you go on the road? To get something to eat, right?
Yes.
Why did the chicken cross the road? The Roman road. Why did the Romans build the road? To go...
Well, for conquest.
Well, for conquest, yeah. Why were they doing conquest?
Well, it's a good question. Yeah, yeah. There was nothing else to conquer.
We're jumping ahead. Yeah. We're jumping ahead. But no, thank you so much for having me. And we've been wanting to do this episode for such a long time now. Because I love your show, Delicious Legacy. And you like mine, I understand.
I love yours.
Yeah, give me a compliment.
The fish sauce, it was like the tomato ketchup of the ancient Roman world, right?
It was a little bit like that.
I mean, but maybe even more ubiquitous. It's almost like salt, like you'd use it in
the sauce. You use it for seasoning, yeah, exactly, instead of salt.
Yeah, The Full English is one of my favorite food podcasts out there.
Yeah, Delicious Legacy, likewise. You go really deep. I like your medieval stuff was really good. Mm,
thanks.
Yeah.
But well, yeah, because yours is about England and about Britain, we'll... go back into the British history and find out...
Pretty far back, hey?
Yeah.
2,000 years, roughly.
Roughly 2,000, yeah. It's a long time.
Yeah. What are the dates? Let's start with that. What are the dates in which the Romans were occupying, we are going to use that word, Britain? So I think, it's like the 663 BC. Is that right? I should know this.
So Julius Caesar did an attempt in 55 BC, I believe?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was unsuccessful.
He wasn't necessarily trying to occupy. He was kind of just proving a point that he was a legend back in Rome.
Yeah.
He came over to Britain, and because I think people had this sense of Britain as this completely foreign place. Obviously not part of the Mediterranean and beyond the landmass that is Europe.
Exactly.
You know, continental Europe.
It was an unknown land.
Yeah.
It was a mythical land.
Okay, I found the date. So Julius Caesar came, 54 and 55 BC. And then the Romans under Claudius came 43
AD. AD.
Yeah. And then people say that they left 410.
409, 410, yeah. It's the dates that the last Roman legions left to fight wars in Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
Good almost 400 years of Roman presence, occupation, whatever the word we're using, in Britain. So we're going to discuss what they brought with them in terms of food and also what the lasting legacies are, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. A lot of stuff to cover.
You know what I really like about this setup is that my microphone is resting on a copy of Game of Thrones. And it's really hard not to think about things like Hadrian's Wall and like conquest and like, you know, warring tribes without thinking of Game of Thrones.
So. It was deliberate, I'll say.
Do you want to tell me the other ingredients in this dish?
Yeah. Coriander, fresh coriander.
Mm-hmm. They love the coriander.
They loved it.
Okay, so coriander, obviously.
Coriander.
Pine nuts.
Fisos.
Obviously.
Obviously, you need fisos and everything. Well, even your dessert.
Even the dessert, yeah, yeah.
And originally, I think it was bay tree berries.
Oh, really? Wow. Berries,
but you know what the Romans used to call the British?
Barbarians?
Sort of, yeah. From a tablet we found at Vidolada in Hadrian's Wall, they used to call them Britonculi, which means wretched little Britons.
Nice.
So I guess they didn't have a good opinion about them.
What did they think about the British people? Just in general, that we were all like completely backward.
Backwards, yeah. They didn't know about food, about civilization, yeah.
Yeah.
But disclosure, I don't like the Romans, so I think I'm with the side of the with the Celts.
Yeah, so maybe we should start with kind of some rough idea of what was going on in Britain before the Romans came. It's maybe in terms of their food and just in general.
Yeah.
Are you able to paint some sort of picture?
Yeah, we have some rough idea. I mean, there were lots of different tribes living across Britain. They were generally pastoralists. Of course, they were a bit hunters and gatherers, and also they grew some millet and some oats and some barley, which is more suitable to the northern climes than wheat. So they had a bit of that stuff happening. But they were, I guess, more in tune with the environment. Their houses were wooden, they were in the edges of forests, they had animals in the forest, they were hunting, they were gathering oysters and seafood from the shores and from the rivers, and generally cooked in cauldrons, or big stews, on wood fire. They had animals like wild boar and beef. They had more beef in this country than in Europe, I would say, like in Rome.
And sheep.
And a bit of sheep, yeah, mutton. And of course, yeah, pig was generally a good thing as well.
Mm.
So yeah, a lot of meat, milk, some bread from barley mainly. And fresh cheese, like cottage cheese type of stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, there was not much of in terms of vegetables in Britain. Yeah, it was wild vegetables, the wild equivalent of the European ones. There was a lot of that. So yeah, I guess there will be a lot of foraging happening.
And to be clear, Britain at this stage, we're just talking about a landmass, a group of islands. There's obviously no real central authority in the country. There's no state to speak of.
No state.
There's obviously no nations. That hasn't been invented yet, the concept of a nation. And so, yeah, we have lots of different kinds of tribes that probably wouldn't even recognize each other properly.
Yeah, yeah, probably they would have different different dialects, speaking differently. They will be in communication with each other to exchange goods as well. Like the Cornish tribes, they would have a lot of tin that would be able to sell. But yeah, the Iceni tribes in the east of, southeast of England, they will have more contact with Europe, with mainland Europe and the Romans. So they would be a bit more in touch. They will have maybe some wine, some olives, some olive oil. So they will have a bit of that. But nothing like we know. Yeah, the people would drink beer. There was no wine.
And there was some trade happening. So like, I know that the ancient Romans knew of this place called Britain before coming here as a place to get tin from, which is an important component in the creation of bronze. And then, as you just said, there were some tribes that had already started slowly to take on some Roman ways and, like, some Roman habits.
Yeah, I think the leaders of the tribes,
yeah,
they would try and copy the opulence of the Roman elite.
Mm-hmm. And this is prior to the invasion.
That's prior to the invasion, yes. And definitely there was a mixture of everybody communicated with each other. There was trade happening, and so yeah, there was definitely contact.
And I love the image of the bubbling cauldron. Yeah, so I was doing some research and I came across a book by a woman called Heather Cool, which is all about the food of ancient Rome in Britain. And she says that, you know, we have this image of the cauldron, the bubbling cauldron. And she says it's more likely, given the amount that we found, archaeologists have found of cauldrons, that that was like slightly more of a special and potentially like elite cooking utensil.
Mm.
And she says that we don't actually know how Iron Age Britons were really eating on the day to day. Still a bit of a mystery.
Mm.
But one thing that I thought was interesting in that book was there's no distinction between cookware and tableware. So like ancient Britons, according to her, didn't really have like bowls, plates, knives, forks, those kinds of things. Like we yeah. must have been, or that those people must have been eating kind of directly out of the pot or whatever it was.
Yeah. So the food shouldn't be too hot. Should be like a room temperature so you can grab it with your hands or with small morsels of bread or serve it on bread, like hard bread, so you use the bread as a plate.
And so obviously to ancient Romans this must have been completely crude and barbaric.
Yeah. But I think the food tastes better this way.
Yeah taste with your hands first.
Yeah but yeah, in terms of how the Romans ate, they ate lying on couches. Mm-hmm. So one hand on the head and the other getting the food. So again, the food was in small portions. There were no forks to speak as such. And you would eat with your hands as well, but with either small morsels of food or with flatbread. Again, you would scoop the bite of meat or cheese or whatever you had with your bread and eat it. So again, you used your hands mainly. So that was something that probably it's common throughout the ancient world.
And then we're going to do a tablespoonful of this garum.
Three.
Yeah. I'm going to do one more because we're not doing salt. I want to taste it. Okay.
Oh, they're looking all right, huh?
Yeah. Let's have it.
What are you? They're looking good, huh?
Yeah.
And they're getting some colour as well.
Yeah.
So obviously before Caesar came and made a bit of an impression on the islands of Britain, and then before Claudius came and invaded and occupied Britain, first contact, as it were, with these mythical islands came from Pytheas. Is that right? I'm getting this from your notes.
Almost. Pytheas.
Pytheas, sorry. Yes. Pytheas.
Yeah.
So that you can tell how much I know about this. Tell me about Pytheas. Who is he and where did he come from?
So he was a Greek navigator, explorer, geographer, that kind of thing. Polymath, as they used to be back then. From Massalia, which is modern-day Marseille, the city of Marseille, one of the biggest ancient Greek colonies in the south of France. So yeah, I guess he was part of an expedition to find new routes to go to Britain for the tin, obviously, for the trade, because the Strait of Gibraltar was occupied by the Carthaginians and they kept a lot of exclusive trade for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess he went via Gaul, what is that modern-day France, and then with a ship, with a boat, explored the whole of Britain and Ireland. And he went even further north, apparently, to Norway. And from his descriptions, from what he survived from his work, because his works hasn't survived the antiquity, unfortunately, from what passages have survived from next explorers and geographers, he might even went to Iceland. And yeah, he described, you know, the floating ice, and he calculated the coastal line of Britain. And so, yeah, we're kind of... think that he was the first that he brought back some more information about this mythical northern frozen misty land into reality. Because before that, nobody knew what was happening there. It was all the kind of fantasies of, you know, blue people, giants, feasting in raw meat or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is, not real.
So there was a kind of mythical idea constructed of Britain in ancient Rome.
Yeah, and I guess the name Britain, Britannia, Britanniki, was one theory that meant the people who painted the body blue they were like the blue painted people, the mm-hmm. painted ones.
Which they would do for war.
Allegedly, yeah.
There's a kind of really interesting thing happening where, so skipping back forward now to ancient Rome, the Romans want to construct the British at once as a kind of barbaric, backward, uncivilized place. But the other sense, they also see them almost like noble savages, but more like warlike savages who are fierce and are worth conquering, are worth having a fight with, and are worth proving yourself that, you know, like if you've conquered this land, it wasn't just walking through and, you know, collecting the resources. It was a fight, you know.
Bizarre notion, but yeah, exactly. I think you're right. That's how they thought about it. But have a cucumber first.
Yeah, let's have a cucumber first. I'm going to have some ancient Roman smashed cucumber.
Yeah.
I'll tell you if it's as good as the one I get at my Silk Road in Camberwell.
Okay. Silk Road, okay.
Am I? Delicious. And you grew these?
Not me, my friend from the allotments.
Oh, yeah. Behind your house is so nice. There's allotments on the back there. Mm. It's really delicious.
Yeah, you don't get too much of the fish sauce.
No, it's just kind of like seasoning.
Mm.
Walnuts. Big fan. You know what? I already know that the ancient Romans did some great stuff for us. Tasting these things, I'm like, yeah, rather dried figs than dried, peas or whatever it was
that
Druids were munching on.
I don't know what they're munching on. Yeah, I mean, there was nothing much there, unfortunately, in Britain before.
I have this sense that Iron Age Britain, because it was seen by Imperial Rome as so backwards and undeveloped and uncivilized, that we're also kind of left with this sense that Iron Age Britain is like just a really impoverished and unknown place. But a bit like how people used to think of the medieval period as the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
There must have been a lot more interesting things going on there. And obviously, you know, people often say that like Celtic culture is so oral. There's such an oral tradition. There remains like very few records of anything that we can look at to really understand Iron Age Britain. But I bet it was amazing and interesting. Don't know much about it.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, they would have songs and poems, and they would have things like that. And that's how they would transmit, I guess, the culture. So just because they haven't survived, it doesn't mean that it wasn't great. Or it wasn't, I guess they had like tradition. That's what I'm trying to say. Just because it was oral and not written, it doesn't mean it wasn't
tradition. And culture and, obviously the language survives.
So, a lot of it,
Okay, so Claudius arrives. Well, in fact, he sends his general over to invade Britain. And I think he turns up a few weeks later with like some elephants.
Yeah.
To cement the invasion. And the question is, what did the Romans bring in terms of food? So where do we start with that? Like, why did they change? Or to what extent did they change the way that we eat?
Yeah, well, obviously, having thousands and thousands of army soldiers coming in and bringing their own food and their own ways, and then staying for about 400 years, it means that slowly you have merchants coming, traders, you would have civil personnel, you would have families, you would have aristocracy, and so retired generals and legionaries would have some land with some their own house and everything else. So you would have a bit of Rome in Britain for all these people. And yes, these people, they would like to eat the stuff that they used to when they were back in Italy, in Rome, or wherever they were from the Roman Empire at that point. Could be North Africa, Spain, Greece, Egypt at that point, all this massive geographical area. So yeah, you would have fruits which didn't grow here, like pear and peach and figs and mulberries and sour cherries and plums. And obviously pomegranates and dates, but these don't grow here. But things like plums and pears, they could grow here as well.
One of them that I really like is leeks, you know?
I know.
And just onions, just kind of banal everyday things like that. Like, the ancient, it kind of seems like timeless, like onions. Surely the Druids were munching on onions.
But the wild equivalent of leeks and asparagus and cabbages.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of the wild plants, but nothing
not cultivated.
Yeah, so when they brought cabbage, they loved cabbage. So the Romans loved cabbage in many different ways, and they ate it also for ailments, like a cure for different things, and also fresh as in salads and so on. So yeah, cabbage was very particular, and as you said, leeks as you said, lettuce, cucumber, turnips, carrots, parsnips.
In terms of the animals that I really like, they bought pheasants, which feels like such a British thing, you know, like a kind of timeless yeah. British thing.
Pheasants and rabbits.
Yeah.
Rabbits as well. Again, so much that you think it's, oh yeah, part of the everyday wildlife and fabric. Right, okay, so I think you can have some fava now.
This is exciting. You know, if there's one thing I like doing more than talking about food, it's eating food.
I'm hungry all the time. But that's the thing, when you talk about food, you get hungrier.
Yeah, it's true. I think preparing for the show, I was like reading a lot about, you know, well, yeah, reading a lot about the kind of food that they were eating. And I didn't really have access to some guinea fowl or some wild venison, or but I did have a bag of frozen peas in my fridge, and I
right.
was kind of reading about the father thing and thought, thanks. And yeah, decided to knock myself up a kind of thing like this from frozen peas, just out of glutton, out of reading reading about it.
So yeah, you would have all this civil personnel and the military personnel in Britain, and they would eat, they would import all this stuff to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it became part of the native flora and fauna over the centuries. Yeah, like pears and
pheasants.
And pheasants and rabbits.
Leeks, yeah. And so, really, you had this occupying force, of which were many legionnaires, and they were eating their army rations, presumably. But then yeah. you also had people that settled and would set up villas and trading ports and yeah. you know, traders and a kind of middle class part of their empire.
Middle class and upper class, yeah. And yeah. a lot of them obviously will be from abroad, but a lot of the local rulers and leaders, they would copy the Roman ways. So they would want to be part of that society.
Because there was an integration of the kind of Celtic elite into that Roman society.
Well,
so
I guess,
some,
yeah.
To some extent.
To some extent, it had to be, right? Because
mm-hmm.
Otherwise...
How do you rule,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, you'll have more wine coming in, perhaps olives and olive oil and all these Roman ways of eating and feasting and living, in a sense.
I think as well, apart from the ingredients that we've been talking about, the thing that really fascinates me about this conversation is also the habits and the culture that Rome brought with them. Because obviously Rome as an empire, one of the things that's distinct about the way they eat is the fact that it's based on trade, it's based on exchange. So some of the things you just mentioned there, like pepper, you know, that wasn't being grown in Italy.
No.
That was coming over presumably from Persia or further east.
Yeah. So from India via Persia. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's kind of interesting, you know, that kind of embracing of a broader non-local source for your food.
Mm.
And they're being transported in these vessels. What did you say they were called? Those
Amphora. Yeah.
The way I was thinking about that, they're kind of like the shipping containers
yeah.
of ancient Rome. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
like the way that like a lot of food is moved around now in these big boats, whatever, you know, like this is what was happening. So they were coming all the way up from the southern Mediterranean, from North Africa, from as far east as we were just saying, India. And then, they were moving around in these vessels and coming, you know, as far as Hadrian's Wall, where some Roman legionaries, you know, expected to be able to drink his wine and so on.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Have their wine and have their spices, like black pepper, coriander, dill, parsley, anise, cumin.
Another aspect of the cultural side of this I find interesting, again, is the opulence. So, like, Rome has a reputation, ancient Rome, in lots of people's minds. I don't know to what extent this is true, but we have this idea that, you know, it was a very, like for the upper classes, for the elite, it was a really opulent way of relating to food. There was a really hedonistic, you know, the lying down and eating grapes thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And was that, did they bring some of that here?
Well, we don't know much, do we, about that? I think to an extent they had brought it, but I think even back in the Roman Empire, this opulence, this extravagant way of living, it was always criticized and it was always mocked.
Mm.
And that's what you get from the poetry and the literature of the day, that they're making fun of this kind of too much excess. And then the philosophers and the moralists of the day, they would always be like, this is not the true Roman way. That's we've been influenced by the barbarians. Mm-hmm. That's not how the Romans should live. true romance would be having bread and the porridge and being more...
more virtuously kind of, yeah, rustic and authentic.
Exactly, yeah.
So yeah, so there's the Feast of Trimacia, which is in Petronius.
Petronius, yes. Satirical, yeah.
And yeah, in his, like, yeah. And so this is, I also know this from a Fellini film, which is worth looking up on YouTube, the scene of this, because it's really bizarre. And so, yeah, this is the classic example, but obviously it's supposed to be a satire.
Mm.
But what he's talking about are all these kind of extreme things where there being this feast, people are eating like sausages made out, like made to look like raw guts, eggs made out of pastry with tiny songbirds inside that you'd crack open, they'd still be alive, and then you eat them. there's like a lot of references to like the nipples and vulva of like cows, which they ancient Romans seems to love eating sexual body parts, at least in this depiction, as I found weird. And just loads of crazy stuff like this, like really, really overly opulent. But as you said, like it becomes a theme of decadence and decline for lots of Roman like interpreters at the time. And then also the way we look back at it and the way it was interpreted later by Victorians.
Exactly. Even in our own modern era, from Victorian time onwards, you have this judgy way of looking back at the past, like that was what brought the decline of the Roman Empire, all these extravagance and opulence and ways of living, which are not moral, basically, immoral ways of living. But I think to an extent, it's not true. I don't think that was something common, to be honest. Even the richest, the richest of the elites. Yeah, they would have a rich meal. They would have more meat, more different meats and wine imported from the corners of the empire. But yeah, I don't think flamingos, tongues and larks' brains was...
the one I really like was dormice.
Dormice.
They love dormice.
So dormice, apparently, with honey.
Yeah, you'd put them in a pot, fatten them up on chestnuts, and then when they got really fat, you'd put them on a spit and cover them in honey and poppy seeds.
Yeah. That was a delicacy. That was rare because I think it's difficult to catch them.
Mm.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah.
Why doesn't Fergus Henderson bring back dormice? You know what I mean? Someone should. Joan. And then in terms of what people were eating in the countryside, it was, and the countryside is probably not the right word, what people were eating in rural areas, peasants basically, that their diets presumably didn't change much in that course of time.
Are we talking about Britain specifically?
Yeah.
I don't think it changed much, no. I think it would be still lots of animals and animal protein and pigs and mutton.
And stews, basically.
Stews, yeah.
So it's really the main impacts during the Roman occupation of Britain, during ancient Roman Britain, was among the elite.
Yeah,
they were the ones who had access to all this trade.
Mostly. I think the most Britons wouldn't care much about that stuff, really. And that kind of is obvious when they left Britain, how quickly the whole thing reverted back to more rural way of living. Like the towns and the cities were abandoned very quickly in real life terms. Not like in a day or two, but people that didn't see a use to be in a city. That didn't, was the point. We want to be in the land, work on the land, have animals, whatever you do. Yeah, you'll be more an agrarian society.
I mean, if this, effectively this huge trading network collapses, that is the Roman Empire, then, you can't hang around in, bathhouses drinking wine, can you?
Yeah. You know, London was completely abandoned for 200 years. Like it was much later in the 9th century that it started being populated again. People would go into these ruins and see all this amazing big house and palace and see who was here. the memory was lost in a sense. And it was abandoned completely. And you would have like trees and everything grow through the ruins and for 300 years or so. And the earth in most places, it was a meter high black earth.
Yeah.
Fertile soil among the ruins because nobody was there.
Right.
So people moved in and they started growing stuff in London. They had plots of lands because the soil was so fertile from all the decaying matter from all these centuries that nobody was there. And the place was abandoned.
Wow.
All the cities and the towns, yeah.
I'd love to have seen that. It'd be very peaceful.
But yeah, in a sense, they were colonial power. I think that's the main point, that the Romans were a colonial power and they brought their own culture because they thought British were barbarians. In a sense, you know, they can define it as they got control of one of the land and of the all the aspects of all the resources of the country for their own good. And they didn't care about the culture, what was there before. And so they brought their own foods and their own stuff. And then when they left, these things went away with them.
I'll be back after this short break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, where's this, Tom? I'm not going to lie, it looks disgusting.
So this is going to be a dessert.
Oh my God, yeah. Cool.
Eggs and pears. The pears are cooked in sweet wine and honey mixture.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's going to be part of the dessert.
I didn't see that one coming. Like, if you... I'll take a photo of this, right?
Yeah.
But it looks brown, like slop, huh?
Yeah, because you
have... I don't want to diss your cooking.
Because you have, obviously, red wine. Syrup.
Yeah.
Red sweet wine. Then it's going to be... going to look weird.
Amazing.
But then, yeah, most of our stuff...
Did you put fish sauce in that?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
There's fish sauce in the dessert?
Yeah.
You freak.
That's the Romans, man. Not me.
Okay, fine. Yum, yum, yum.
You will like that. You will like that.
Obviously, you know that Roman Britain wasn't like a monolith and there was diversity and there was obviously huge stratification in terms of if you lived in the city or in the rural area and if you were part of the elite or you weren't. But let's just imagine for a moment that we were, I guess, part of the elite in Roman Britain and you'd invited me over for dinner, as you have. What are we sitting down to eat? What kind of foods are there?
Well, you would have all sorts of delicacies. Talking about dried figs and olives imported from Mediterranean. You'll have nice red wines. You'll have spit roast meats. And you'll have garum, which is the fish sauce. And it's ubiquitous. It was kind of the thing that would have on the table the most expensive fish sauce. And people would serve themselves like tiny drops to season their food. Garum, as we said, it was something that was produced in the Mediterranean, with fish and salt, basically, and you let it do its thing in the sun, ferment in a way. And this, then you extract the liquid, and that was used as a seasoning in food.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was like every Roman elite would have some garum. And we find a lot of little clay pots with remains of garum.
Probably still smells like it because it's really punchy, that stuff.
Yeah, what do you think? So we have here in front of us some recreation of garum.
Where has it gone? We tried it. Oh yeah, there it is. Yeah, I've come across this stuff before and it's punchy. It stinks, to be frank. But it's delicious when you put it with stuff. It's like Thai fish sauce.
Yes.
You know, if you smell out of the bottle, it smells weird. But when you add it to something, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and you don't taste it in the food. It's part of the...
Right. Apart from you had a spoonful just a second ago and you look like you're almost going to be sick.
Yeah, it's very salty. Let's say that.
And wine was obviously a huge thing. So like the wines that they were getting would be variable in strength and often incredibly strong. So they were drank with water. Is that right? And sometimes spiced as well?
Spiced wine for sure. And sweet wine, sweetened wine with honey mainly honey and spices. That would be one of the things. But the Greeks used to drink wine with water. The Romans didn't mix it with water so much. The wine would be of a varying quality. You would have very vinegary tasting wine, which was part of the rations again for soldiers, for legionaries. So they will carry some of this very cheap vinegary tasting wine with them to drink. The elites will drink something sweet, which we can try.
Oh, wow.
We'll have some sweet wine.
This is a sweet, made from a sweet grape variety.
Yeah.
Or you just added some sugar, some red wine.
No.
Tell me the truth. Cheers. No, it's super sweet. It's delicious.
So one of the manuals from ancient Rome, De Agricultura, Cato and Columella, in another one, they talk about how you leave the grapes into the vine until the very end of the season to dry naturally. And then you pick them up, you let them dry in baskets and so on, and they get concentrated, and then you make your wine with that.
Right.
And you have sweeter wine in that respect. Yeah, the Romans, yeah, the taste palette, it was, yeah, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, nothing like the modern Italian food, and modern Italian
There's no aubergine, there's no tomato, there's no basil. We were just talking earlier, like how they love coriander.
How they love coriander.
And if you know Italians, like, I mean, I don't know many. I know a few Italians and I don't know many that like coriander.
And they would like their food sweet. So all the sauces were very sweet with honey.
Because they didn't have sugar or not much of it.
No, they didn't have sugar. Yeah, they didn't know about sugar.
And so they were sweetening the things, with grapes and fruit and honey mainly.
Yeah, exactly.
When I learned that, I was like, did they have bee suits? They must have got stung all the time when they wanted to get, because they were consuming so much honey. Think of the poor beekeepers without the masks, like the slave. They would have been slaves.
Slaves,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. God, there's a lot going on behind the surface, isn't there? You know?
So you have the Roman food, the Roman taste, you'd have very sweet and very sour and spiced. They would love them. So you have the garum, which is the fishy, salty, umami kind of stuff. You would have sweet with honey and dates and syrups from grapes and pomegranates and so on. You have the vinegar with honey and with your spices. So black pepper or long pepper was important and was used generously by the elites, obviously, in every food. And you would have cheese as well. You would eat a lot of nice cheeses. They would make a paste like a pesto with celery leaves and garlic and coriander leaves and parsley leaves and vinegar and cheese. And that was very strong, very pungent. You would eat that as a starter with some bread.
I like the sound of that. I love when you mention the fact that ancient Roman food was heavily spiced with strong sweet and sour flavors. It makes me think that they must have thought that native British food was bland.
Which is
2,000 years of people thinking that native British food is bland.
Some things don't change.
Yeah.
Strabo, the geographer, says that the British talking about the native British, they have lots of milk, but they don't eat cheese. Mm. So that was another thing that kind of made impression to them. I guess they meant mature cheese, like hard cheese, because there was cottage cheese, as we said earlier on. But yeah, so this kind of very big pungent flavors, there was nothing really, yeah. I mean, apart from probably mustard seeds. So mustard, I think, probably was growing wild and you can use it as a spice.
Mm.
And bog myrtle was another spice, yeah, used here. But there was nothing else growing. So, yeah, the food must have been bland, let's say. But I mean...
This brings us back to the kind of, you know, ancient Romans loving food, the cultural aspects of food and loving, you know, enjoying food.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, ancient Britons. Well, we just don't know, really.
We don't know.
But yeah, there wasn't a lot going on in terms of, you know... Another thing that the ancient Romans brought was watercress, which feels, again, like a really long-standing British kind of thing to have with your roast beef and stuff.
Yeah,
on. But yeah. Yeah, that strong flavour came. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Didn't exist. Yeah.
Me too.
Not to speak of roast beef and mustard, yeah.
Mm, and they also brought snails.
Oh, yeah, snails, edible snails.
Yeah, that was another thing.
That was like an aperitif thing. Yeah, where's the snails, man?
Well, I'll tell you where they are, in the garden. They're eating my vegetables.
The real thing that sets this burger, I mean, what was the description for this? They didn't give it a title.
No, there was no, it's like...
The recipes don't have like titles.
No, like meatballs on the style of X or what was that or Y.
Right.
Yeah.
So the real thing that separates this from the burger as we know it, apart from the fact it's made with part pork and it's got garum and it's got pine nuts and it's got coriander, apart from those things,
mm-hmm.
is that it's wrapped in core fat, right?
Yeah, which is a lot more like... Have you eaten faggots. Cypriot... faggots, okay. As well. Yeah. Faggots, exactly.
What were you going to say?
Seftalia, it's a Cypriot meatball.
Okay.
Wrapped in core fat.
It's a delicious thing, core fat.
We've got the Roman burgers in front of us. And, well... Tom, why don't you say where this recipe comes from?
So this is from the Book of Apicius, or Apicius, which was written between the 1st century and the 4th century AD. And it's like an instruction, a cooking manual, with like 400 recipes, I think, so something like that. And it has the name of the legendary gourmand called Apicius, Marcus Gavius Apicius. And there's lots of recipes about, yeah, you have fish, you have meat, you have vegetables, sauces, and... the recipes back then, it wasn't like, okay, you have 50 grams of this and you cook it for an hour, and it was just...
They were just vibing.
Vibing, yeah.
Yeah.
X, Y, Z.
Yeah. Get to work.
Mass it, yeah.
Yeah. The X, Y, Z here is minced meat, which was specified as could be beef, could be pork. And then...
Wrapped
in core fat.
Yeah.
And it contains also coriander... pine nuts, garum, obviously, everything's got garum, including the desserts, and some pepper. No salt, because the garum does the seasoning. And, well, the thing is, it looks quite a lot like a burger, right?
Yeah, it looks like a burger.
So this is why you wanted to cook it, because your claim is the ancient Romans gave Britain the burger.
Yes, I think so.
McDonald's, watch out.
Yeah, right.
Okay, let's do it. If you've ever had a faggot, a traditional British Welsh, I believe, recipe, this looks a bit like that, but flatter, because the core fat gives it that appearance.
So I do have, yeah. I like faggot.
Yeah.
Mm.
With faggots with gravy.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. Anything wrapped in loads of fat is hard not to like, right?
Yeah.
I like the pine nuts. This doesn't feel Italian. It doesn't feel British either. It's completely something else.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely some sort of flavour that... Yeah, you can't really describe it as Mediterranean or...
Mm. Coriander, for me, gives Indian food. But the pine nuts are like Mediterranean. And then the core fat is just really rich and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have, yeah, if you like fat flavors, yeah, then it's great.
I think we should start a pop-up, Tom, where we do ancient Roman burgers, core fat burgers.
Mm.
We need, listeners, if you're listening, we need a name for that pop-up. Let us know. I'm a fan. You know what it needs, though? It needs, I'm going to put some more garam on it. I was going to say it needs some mustard and some ketchup and a gherkin. Actually, we have the gherkins.
We have marinated cucumber.
Okay, great. And oh yeah, it's got the kind of sauce with it as well. So if we're living in our ancient Roman Britain in an upper class household, it would be the slaves making this for us, right? Presumably the ancient Romans brought with them slaves.
Yeah, yeah, you'd have your slaves. It could be locals, yeah, but a rich family would bring their own personnel as well.
I think one thing that's really important to realize about the ancient world that maybe it's quite obvious, but racism hasn't been invented yet. So when we talk about slaves, we're not talking about people that aren't white. It's a distinction that has to do with just being free or not, which is it's like a legal distinction.
In a sense, yeah, yeah. But it's more complicated than that as well. Slaves were necessary, part of the pre-industrial world, of course, for the economy. But I guess, yeah, it's difficult to say that they weren't property per se. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't so much... They weren't lower than animals, I suppose. You wouldn't say that.
No, and yeah. you could also buy your way out of slavery, or you can earn your way out of slavery. So that's what I mean by like a legal distinction. It was like a title that you were kind of held in.
Yeah.
I mean, also, so back to the kind of the racism thing, you get examples of North African soldiers up at Hadrian's Wall, yeah, where you'll get them using Latin and their native tongue, which is just fascinating, you know.
And one thing that Romans were influenced by the Northerners, by the Brits, it was so the Roman soldiers in Hadrian's Wall, they were also drinking beer.
Mm.
They were drinking a lot of beer. So part of the tablets that they found, one of the notes was like, bring us some beer. We don't have beer here. So it wasn't just them, Romans influencing Britons with their own ways of food and wine. It was also working the other way around as well.
Yeah, that's what I found really fascinating about that, because I was trying to find examples of exchange going both ways, which must have happened.
Mm.
And beer seems to be the only example that we can find from those tablets, which we recovered in the Northeast. But apart from that, Britain was still really peripheral to the empire, right? They were...
Yeah.
It's not like there were any, like, senators from Britain in the Roman Senate or any kind of exchange on, like, that deeper political level. And, like, I don't think there's any... Beyond beer, I can't think of any examples, in the admittedly quite small amount of research I did, of the exchange going both ways.
Yeah, I think that's true. We don't have much information about working the other way around. But yeah, we know that beer was one of the important things that went
and
south.
And still is.
Yeah.
At least to my heart, you know? So eventually, obviously, the Romans leave Britain after almost 400 years. And not long after that, you know, Rome kind of enters a kind of terminal decline. The Romans pull out of Britain. What of their influence remains in terms of food?
Culture-wise, very little. Probably nothing for the initial couple of centuries, in many respects, really. Just a memory, just a faint memory. In terms of the ingredients, a lot of them there become native, as we said earlier on, to the British Isles.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, vegetables and fruits, they become cultivated by people, everyday people. And then, yeah, animals as well, like perhaps rabbits and snails that become part of the fauna of the islands, and pheasants as well. So these ingredients form part of the ladder, of the local ladder. But in terms of culture, food culture, I think there's nothing we can say it remains.
Right.
We can basically say that people reverting more or less back to a more Celtic way of living.
With some Saxon influence, some German.
And then, yeah, you have the Saxons and then other invading forces from the north.
But none of which really until, I guess, the Renaissance kind of pick up ancient Roman ways again.
Yeah, I think so. We have the medieval period, which is obviously you still have different elements of... you have spices, you have wine, imported from France this way, because France, most of France was part of England. Yeah, you bring wine, Bordeaux wine, and so on. But in terms of the direct influence from ancient Rome to Britain, there's nothing until after the Renaissance, and especially going towards the Victorian era and afterwards.
Yeah, and so spices pretty much leave this country until like the Crusades or something. So in the 11th century.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, back to bland, I guess.
And they also, obviously, they were carrying cheese with them as part of the ration.
Mm-hmm.
So you obviously to carry cheese on an expedition must be cheese that lasts. So it has to be hard cheese.
Yeah, when we talk about the lasting effects of Rome, Britain, I think another way to think about this could be in terms of Christianity. And I know it's disputed in terms of who brought Christianity and how Christianity was transferred to Britain. But it's surely the case that the networks between Britain and Rome, you know, the seat of Christianity, were made through this connection. And so obviously the Roman occupation played a big part in that. And so, like, Christianity has obviously completely transform Britain's relationship with food, if you think in terms of fasting and the kind of diet that, and the feasting and ritual and so on. So I think that could be seen as a lasting legacy, maybe, but I don't know if that's a bit of a stretch.
Yes and no, yeah. I can see what you mean. I can see it as a legacy of Rome, in a way. Mm-hmm. A new religion coming here and fostering a way of life which... It has the feast days and the fast days, and you have the festivals like in Christmas and Easter that you will eat more meat, and then you have the periods of you will live from the land and very seasonal. And in that respect, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's one of the legacies that lasted all these centuries and thousands of years since Roman occupation. I think maybe that's more of a modern thing, to be honest. When, again, ancient Rome became fashionable and came back to the forefront in Victorian Britain with all the discoveries made in the land of Britain of ancient Roman ruins, and obviously all the upper classes, the aristocracy going for the tours of Roman remains in Italy. So they brought back the fact that Rome was great, imperial rule was good, because they had an empire as well. Mm-hmm. You have the British Empire at that point expanding and covering all this land, all these different masses and nations and people. So I guess they want to bring an element of we have a continuity from ancient Britain to today, and we are the Imperial Rome today, and they were good. Mm-hmm. They brought civilization to these islands, mm-hmm. and we bring civilization to the world.
Yeah.
I think part of that link, perhaps, they did actually try to justify many things, as you said, with the roles of the women and the peasants and the different class systems. I think that was a lot of trying to link it to that imperial system.
It was like a post-rationalization.
Yeah,
so this gender division of labor had already been taking place.
Yeah,
and they were kind of rationalizing in ancient Roman terms.
Yeah, yeah. And like it's normal and good. And yes, they were 2,000 years ago, and we bring more civilization to other people. So we are kind of taking the baton and passing it.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's definitely not a coincidence that the Victorians were kind of obsessed with ancient Rome. And there's lots of examples of that in literature, in like political speeches. I think there was a whole like fashion for Victorians to like pose in ancient Roman dress and like take photos of themselves. And I was just wondering on that, like if... It's not only using ancient Rome to justify the British Empire, which in the Victorian period was at its peak, or reaching its peak, but also I wonder if the way in which Roman decadence was understood to be a symptom of decline might also explain kind of some of the opposite tendency in our food culture, which is to say that like Victorians and certainly Britain in general is quite known for like culinary like austerity, for being quite austere and dour and, you know, not into opulence. And I wonder if part of that was fed by the fact that, yeah, Victorians looked at ancient Rome and saw these giant feasts and saw this decadence and saw it as a symptom of decline and something that they shouldn't repeat in order to hold their own empire together.
Yes.
Again, that's another stretch, but I'm good at making these kind of speculative claims.
I know what you mean. I mean, yeah, they do sound very speculative, but I think there is always this element of the moral element of the people who lived in the time that they say, okay, we cannot possibly have this luxury. That's a sin for X, Y reason. So how do you transmit that to people saying, okay, if we become so decadent, then we will collapse the Roman Empire collapsed all these years ago. So yeah, I think there is an element of that.
Because like the Tudors were into that decadent stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they loved a like huge pheasant or peacock or something, you know, stuffed. And
feasts.
All that kind of went away, you know, in the Elizabethan and Victorian.
On that note, also, obviously the aristocratic people, the elites, they still had many, many huge feasts. They had their evening meals were stretching for hours. You had all these different courses. And I guess, yeah, that was in stark contrast to what the poor people ate. So you had really, really small elite who ate gloriously.
Mm.
And you had the big population in the industrial era that...
Oliver Twist style, holding a bowl out for some porridge or something. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think there was an element on that. Okay, we have to tip the balance a little bit because there is injustice and that will bring decline. And this decline will bring the collapse of the empire. So we have to do something to make it a bit more...
liberal and equal.
Yeah. So I think there was always all these links and tenures, or not so tenures, with the Roman Empire.
I mean, the other comparison, if we're making it between Victorian Britain and Roman Britain, was Britain became part of a global trading network.
Mm.
So pepper, again, becomes available. But, you know, the Victorians are quite happy to eat things like kedri, you know, like basically rice porridge with loads of curry powder or whatever it would be.
Yeah,
you know?
I think,
so there's, again, there's a kind of cosmopolitanism, an embracing of the foods of empire as part of your own. Like, so, you know, ancient Romans, as you say, loved pepper, but it wasn't because pepper came from Rome, but pepper was accessed through the empire, and that therefore was Roman. You know?
Yeah.
And I guess the same thing with the Victorians' kind of confidence around eating spices. Like, it wasn't seen as something outside of Britain, seen as something inclusive, part of the empire.
But, yeah, it's part of what we look at us. We have all the stuff. We're rich.
Yeah, exactly. And also familiar, like, belongs to us. It's entitled. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a confidence there. That was a super interesting conversation. And, you know, more importantly, the food was actually really delicious. So, Tom, thank you so much for that. Thanks for inviting me over.
We have one more course.
Do we have? Oh, my God. Yeah, we have the fish sauce cake. Okay, so Tom, when I arrived, showed me what can only be described as a kind of like winey pear slushy slurry thing that I was dubious about before he said that it contains fish sauce as well, and then I was even more dubious about it.
You're selling it very well.
But after it's been in the oven, it's come out, it just looks like a cake. It looks quite nice. There's no flour in it though. It's like more like a custard.
Yeah.
And there's obviously no sugar in it.
There's honey. Yeah, and it's with pears. So it's called patina with pears. So it's like a egg set with fruits and sweet and with honey.
And the wine will bring some sweetness to it as well, yeah.
So let's try this. But before you try it.
Do you know if did the ancient Romans have sweet ending the meal? Because that division always seems quite strange to me, that division between savory and sweet.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, like I said, a lot of the main courses, they were full of honey and sweet and sour. So there was not...
Yeah, that's much more modern.
Yeah. You would have your dried fruits with maybe with your wine course at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, not...
Like in Chinese food,
yeah.
You know, sugar or in a lot of Asian food, like sugar just features throughout.
Yeah.
You don't just have the sweet thing in the end.
Yeah, yeah. I think in that respect, yeah, ancient Roman and Greek cuisine was a lot more similar to the Far Eastern cuisines. Like, to my mind, that makes sense. Like, it seems like the Chinese and the ancient Greek and Roman were more close than than today's cuisine.
Wow. Yeah, tell that to a modern Italian.
I will. I'm not afraid of them. Right, so try it without the sauce. So we have the honey wine sauce now. So let's try it without it. Because that should be fruity. And it has also cumin, spiced with cumin. Ah,
oh, wow.
And it's black pepper.
Oh, wow.
You finish it with black pepper.
Extra edition. Okay, this cake just gets weirder and weirder, man. Grating some black pepper on the cake. Wow, it's so strange. The cumin's really strong. I like it. It's weird.
It's nothing like you had ever before.
No. It's like a kind of like spicy, sweet baked omelette. I like it. I like that it's incredibly weird. That's the kind of experience I wanted to have.
Yeah.
Everything else was too nice.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, yeah. That's the thing. I mean, that's why I was interested in cooking ancient food. Because despite all the evidence we have, archaeological, scientific, analyzing all the remains and the modern chemical techniques that they can trace what is in the pots, right? And all the literally evidence from the ancient world, you know, all these different, that describe all the foods they ate, yes. But we don't know how it tastes.
Right, really, right,
right.
It's like as close as you can get to really working out what it like feels like to be there.
Yeah.
It's really hard to like see anything that yes. would like, with our eyes, because if you go to a ruin, it's a ruin. It's not, and it's also a tourist site, so you don't see the thing. We can't hear anything. We can maybe reconstruct some of the music, but you know, this is actually like we're tasting the past, which sounds a bit naff, I'm gonna say, but it's true, right?
So let's drink some normal wine.
Hail Caesar.
Good to see you.
Yeah,
thanks
brilliant.
For coming into the Delicious Legacy.
Thank you so much for having me. Great collaboration. A delicious collaboration.
Delicious collaboration, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on this adventure in the land of ancient Britain. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and the food and discussion inspired you for some ancient Roman British food. I've been Thomas Dinas with my guest Louis Bassett, and thank you for today. This podcast can only be happening with your generous support, so thank you so much for listening and for your reviews and for being such great people. See you again soon. Goodbye.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.